My name is John Wedger. I'm a retired Metropolitan Police detective. I came to prominence really for my role as a whistleblower in the area of child abuse investigations, where I was a specialist. I was a specialist interviewer for Scotland Yard's child abuse units, and I blew the whistle in circa 2005 regarding the deliberate, and I mean deliberate, cover-ups of child prostitution within the capital, in which kids from care homes, their ages range from 9 to 14 years old, were being taken from a place of safety under the supervision of social services and pimped out by various individuals. And this was all known by the Metropolitan Police. The kids all said the same things, that they were taken to various locations ranging from crack houses to very, very upmarket Mayfair restaurants, and that there was the involvement of a police, the judiciary, a judge, and various members of the BBC were on the client list of these kids. And when I reported my findings, I was threatened by one of the UK's most senior detectives with the loss of my home, my job. Was it my home, my job, and my children? How could I forget that one? If I ever mentioned to anyone what I had uncovered, I continued to blow the whistle, because my main two witnesses were subsequently found dead in suspicious circumstances. So I spoke out, and then I endured a four-year campaign of bullying by the Metropolitan Police, because the threats were carried out as they tried to imprison me on 9 occasions, tried to bankrupt me, tried to have my home taken off me, and tried to take my youngest child into care. I now campaign for justice for victims and survivors of abuse, and I go around the country speaking to ex-offenders, many of who have endured torment as a child in various care homes. So that's me.
You're describing the Met as basically a criminal gang at the top. You know, obviously some of the work they do is laudable, but it doesn't really cut the mustard with Londoners, does it? If the end result is that when the really powerful criminals are not simply not arrested, they're actually protected by the Metropolitan Police. And you talked there about this campaign against you. You say you endured that campaign. How did you survive it? Because surely almost nobody could stand up to such a massive institution as the Metropolitan Police. If they're out to get you, you're going to get caught.
Well, at the time, my saving grace, and this sounds very perverse, was Sir Jimmy Savile, the patron saint of helping children. He was exposed posthumously as being the evil, predatory paedophile that he was, that the system knew about at the highest possible level. But what that did was that put the focus back on all those who've been speaking out about child abuse and its cover-ups, and it gave them an air of credibility. And there was a few MPs that sort of piggybacked onto this, and they started actually being a voice for survivors of care homes, many of which went on to live quite dysfunctional lives and ended up with various addictions and a criminal history behind them, which the court system did denigrate them as people of bad character. And so there was no substance to what they were saying. But in doing so, other police officers were highlighted that had spoken out. So we had an officer in the north of England had spoken out about the Rochdale grooming gangs, and there was a few more. But I mean, one of the bravest ones was a senior officer, and it's really good when you get a senior officer speaking out. There was two that I've got total respect for. One was Lenny Harper, who spoke out bravely about the cover-up of kids not just being sexually abused, but being tortured and murdered at a care home in Jersey called Hope de la Garenne. He did some unbelievable work improving that the allegations that survivors were saying was true. He, in turn, shed the spotlight on the hierarchy of the island of Jersey, which has got a bizarre feudal system still going. He was threatened in a very similar way. The officer in the north of England was threatened in a very similar way. And then we had the sterling work of Mike Veal, the chief constable from Wiltshire, who bravely spoke out about the paedophilic and murderous and raping activities of our former Prime Minister Ted Heath. And Mike Veal, to this day, is still subject to an awful campaign to silence him for what he did in exposing this repugnant criminality. So it's an ongoing thing.
Just to be clear, sorry, John, but just to be clear about Heath, because I was the BBC reporter in Salisbury for many years. About a year, actually, not for many years. But, that's where Heath was living. My information from people who were not sympathetic to, but quite close to Ted Heath through the sailing community, was he wasn't interested in underage kids. I mean, in other words, before puberty, but he had a real penchant for sort of 13, 14-year-old boys. And this isn't really classed specifically as paedophilia, but it is certainly is, sexual abuse of underage children. Let's just try and unpick some of this, because how is it that the establishment is able to get away with this sort of thing? How does it work within the police service? Is there an outside body that will literally, I mean, whether this is, say MI5 or, say, I'm just guessing here, the royalty, that will intervene when senior police decide they want to prosecute paedophiles? Because I can remember we had a terrific chief constable who turned up in Avon and Somerset that actually revived some cases that previous chief constables had swept under the carpet, particularly with a guy called Philip. I can't remember his second name, but anyway, he was the mayor of there, but he was also a child abuser, and his daughter had died in suspicious circumstances, having set fire to herself. So where is it? What happens when a senior police officer actually thinks to themselves, well, actually, I'd rather like to prosecute this very senior public figure because they're abusing children?
Well, I can't answer for senior officers because I never made it that high. I can say it from a foot soldier, on a detective, on a cold face level, that you work for a disciplined service. So it's very, very structured, disciplined, and you obey orders. And that is the overarching tenet. You will obey orders. And so you become answerable to the first line of management, which will be your inspector. And then if it gets past there, then it goes up the food chain. I was intercepted at a very, very low level. I was intercepted by a detective inspector who said, you can't put this out. This can't happen. And I continued because I ignored him because I had no respect for him. And it then went up to chief superintendent. And it goes above that. And it does go above that. What we saw was whatever people's views on it was, we had the IICSA, the independent investigation into child sexual abuse, which was born out of the allegations that were flooding out regarding Savile and Co, politicians and all sorts. So we had the Elm Guest House. We had a whole plethora of these scandals that came out at the same time. Or they came to notice at the same time, because there's been a lot of survivor groups have been speaking and shouting from the highest level for many, many years, and nothing is done. So when the public make a complaint, they're easily silenced. They're just told, yeah, we're looking at it, we'll get back to you. And if they pursue it any further, they're basically told to shut up. But when an officer like myself, Lenny Harper and Mike Veal, especially Mike Veal being the chief constable, and bear in mind, Mike Veal openly stated on Sky News that there was evidence linking Ted Heath to Satanism. So let's get that right as well. And that was openly declared. It becomes a problem for the system if, for whatever reason, and I don't think we will ever know what these reasons are until there is a full disclosure after the 100-year rule and stuff like that that gets implemented, because D notices come in. Now, one of the explanations might be that the information that people like myself and others had could be politically damaging, politically destabilizing for the United Kingdom and its overseas territories. And in saying that, what I mean is that the people that are utilizing the children for their paedophilic means could be people that are caught up in our establishment, our decision-making elite. Now, if that is the case, then these people are going to be open to blackmail. And we recently saw a speech made by Vladimir Putin when he alluded to the fact that the US and the UK political elite are paedophiles. Now, he might or might not be right on that one. I would say that information that I'd received would sort of go to proving that some of what he's saying is correct. Now, years ago, if someone was having an affair and they were a politician, they become a risk, because they could be coerced into making wrongful decisions by means of blackmail. Because years ago, when we had a Christian moralistic society, to have an extramarital affair was frowned upon. It was appalling. It was disgusting. Then people had affairs and it didn't really matter because standards went down. The other thing was, it was illegal to be a homosexual. So when you got a politician that was a homosexual, he could then be conned or he could face imprisonment or coerced by a foreign power or whatever with threats to exposure. So that was a lever. But now the law's changed and that's no longer the case. Cocaine, again, we've had many politicians been exposed for sniffing cocaine. We even had our prime minister, it came out and, you know, he admitted it, that he'd stuck his penis into the head of a dead pig, you know, and nothing's done about it because it doesn't matter. Whereas paedophilia is still that last hurdle that society refuses to overcome. You know, it's still, and rightly so, seen as an abhorrent crime, and it is an abhorrent crime. It's a crime that destroys lives, whatever age it is. You know, if the law says under 16, then under 16 for a reason. And whether Ted Heath is abusing 12, 14-year-old boys, it's perverse, it's illegal, and it's wrong, and it's damaging to them children. So however they want to justify that one, I don't know. So you get the intelligence services. It is their job to prevent anything which could cause political, economic or financial instability of our nation. And they come in and they serve what's known as D notices, which are defence notices, which are a tool used by the military intelligence. They're not a civilian tool. The police have nothing to do with D notices. It's not for the civilians. So it's a military weapon that was brought in circa First World War. This loose lips sink ships. I think Churchill was, the instigator of the D notice. And so we've seen it used a lot when it comes to child abuse inquiries. And I can remember I got a position within the police within intelligence, in which I would be dealing with every single level. Intelligence is graded. It's a tier system. And at the very top is top secret. And the unit I was on would be dealing with top secret information. So I had to undergo the most thorough, intrusive vetting that you could. And in that, during that vetting process, we are all interviewed and we are given a speech by a senior officer. And they're basically told that if you think there is anything that's going to cause you to fail the vetting, then you can honourably leave now. But if we find out after all this work, the situation would be different. So people are given a chance to walk away. And some of the things which would disqualify you would be your sexual activities. And the majority of homosexuals back when I applied for it that applied for vetting were refused, and it was official. And the sergeant was a lesbian. She actually gave a speech, and she said because of the fact that there is a greater propensity for multiple partners, polyamorous relationships, which could cause a lever in some way, an emotional lever, a criminal lever, an economic lever, you will fail vetting. But if you're straight and you're involved in swinging or dating websites, you will fail vetting. You will fail it. And that's just how it is. So even on a police level, it is seen as you know, when you have got these sexual proclivities, you have got this private sexual life, which is liberal or perverse, it can be of use to the other side. And this is official. But with the police, if you are caught in these situations and you are in these positions, you're removed from post immediately with immediate effect. When I was on Vice, we worked with prostitutes, and we would be involved in brothel raids and things like that. And some of it, you know, it could be quite sort of high marketplaces, right? But what our superintendent used to say, if anyone is caught in a brothel or seem to go back to these places afterwards for a free massage or whatever, you're removed from post and you are also going to face discipline. We were not even allowed to enter any late night drinking venues because there's a chance that it could influence us. So there was strict. Now a politician can commit a crime and go to prison for a sentence one day less than a year and keep their job, remain in post, whereas police can't. So the fact that these cover-ups occur would indicate, in my opinion and my experience, that there's someone high up, preferably politically, involved, and that would be the need for a cover-up.
Yeah, well, I wonder if the situation is still the same now, John. I mean, was it 20 years or so since you were bullied out of the Met?
Well, I retired, but they bullied me. No two ways about it. But I fought back and I retired. So it was my decision to leave, not theirs, because I'd done absolutely nothing wrong. But it was a dangerous game I played. And even a cabinet minister approached me and said that Theresa May had warned politicians not to deal with me. Theresa May herself openly warned politicians not to come near me. I had another politician class me as a conspiracy theorist, where everything I said proved to be the case. Luckily, the information I had, I got it before the Justice Jay, the chair of the IICSA, and it became court exhibit, so they couldn't sanitize that information. And as a result of my information, that 5 points of law regarding safeguarding and edifying, safeguarding for children are now in place and have to be adhered to by social services and the police alone. But it's a very dangerous game you play, and you've got to really have the heart for it, because they will hurt you, and when they come after you, they will do damage. But what I say to people, if you're going to blow the whistle, be clean. Be clean. Have nothing on you, because if they have anything on you, you're in trouble. And this is why I think you see people withdraw or fall at the first hurdle, because there's a bit of dirt that the police had on them. They had nothing on me.
I would say almost everybody has got some dirt on them somewhere. Anyway, we were reporting on this chap, Trevor Morris, who was a police officer who infiltrated the Stephen Lawrence campaign.
Yeah.
The inquiry, he said something very interesting. He said that my job was to protect the Lawrence family and to gather intelligence for the police. We didn't do any kind of smears at all. That was MI5's job. And he actually said that before the live feed was cut. And the chair of the inquiry stated an hour later when it resumed that bit would be struck from the record. But thankfully, it was actually on the live recording where he was saying that was the job of... So anyway, what I suppose what I'm saying here is that you've got a rather seedy world, haven't you, of these police infiltrating legitimate groups, but also of recruiting these participant informants, haven't you?
Well, I'm going to give you an example. When we used to raid a brothel, the MO would be someone like myself would, if we were looking for young kids, we'd ring up, we'd look at the advert, and it would say 18-year-old. And we knew that it was a lie. They wouldn't be 18. They would be 16 or 15. We'd ask them, you know, for the details. And they'd say, oh, we've got Camille. She's 18. She's voluptuous. All this nonsense. And I'd say, oh, please book her. I'm on my way. And I go down there, and I pay my entry fee, be allowed through the security door, and I would then obstruct the door before the security team could deal with me, and our team would come in and we would hit them very, very hard, and we would spread out, we call it bomb bursting, we would go to every room, forcibly kick the door open, and we would detain everyone in place looking for vulnerable children, right? And that was a protocol of raiding a brothel. Some information came in that there was young boys at a gay brothel. Now, there's not many of them, but the main one was in the Earls Court area. And Earls Court cropped up a lot in the IICSA inquiry involving people high up and young boys and rent boys and all sorts. So it's a notorious area for our, I don't know, whatever you will call them, those higher up the echelons and their involvement with young rent boys. And so I was on the briefing, and I was told by the senior officer, right, I want you to go in, John's usual briefing, but you're to stand by and wait further instructions, all right? So we put the call in. We attended this brothel, which was in a very, very nice old Victorian house around the back of, it's in Nevin Place. So I'll never forget it, Nevin Place, around the back of Earls Court Station. And then all of a sudden, the senior officer turned up and said, right, we're not to go in, we're to knock. We had to knock. Their reception said, who are you? We had to identify ourselves as a police. We were told to wait outside for 10 minutes. No one was allowed in. We were then ushered through into a reception area where we were given a cup of tea. And we were told to wait until the brothels, the rent boy brothels solicitor turned up, which took an hour. And then under escort of their legal representative, we were then shown through every single room, which was, but if there was a young boy in there, you know, he could be in Birmingham by the time we went in there. And this goes to show the disparity and the corruption when it involves young rent boys, because maybe that is a weakness of our political elite. I don't know. But, you know, when we hear about the two-tier policing, and also when there is the involvement of the intelligence services, yes, of course, you know, and there's an old mantra within that line of covert policing, and it's deny it if asked. If anyone thinks that they're going to tell the truth on matters like this, well, they're stupid, you know, more fool you get what you deserve, a mouthful of lies, and them lies will precipitate down from the top. And that is a truth. And this is from someone who has lived it. You know, they will lie. I was told by a senior officer who went on to become one of the UK's most senior officers. His name is out there and his name is in the court transcript of my civil case, right? And he turned around to me and said, John, what you've exposed is going to F us past, present and future. We're screwed if this ever gets out. And he said, you'll be thrown to the wolves. You do have no understanding how deep this goes. I never didn't at the time, but now I do, because I didn't think it was that corrupt. And he turned around and said to me, how do you think you've been treated? I said, appallingly. He said, yes, you have. He said, now, I'll tell you what, put in a complaint, a 163 it was called, a grievance form, right? I've never done it before. I've never complained about anyone. And he said, you know, the life of a grievance form, the audit trial. And I went, no. He said, well, it gets ratified by your manager. It comes up to the OQ commander, which is me. I sign it off. It then goes off to be adjudicated. And then it comes back to me. And do you know where it goes from there? And I went, no. And he just pointed to the bin. He goes, it goes in there and it stays in there. If you think I'm going to betray senior rank and they do likewise, you're an effing idiot. You know, so this is how it is. This is the reality of it. Now, will they stand up in court and say that? No, because they're liars. And their briefing comes from high up. And so,
yeah, but I mean, one of the problems at the moment is that there are lots of, as has come out in this spy cops hearing, there are a lot of these informants, not just police officers in these organisations. Do you think there's any kind of diligence done when it comes to recruiting informants? Because it might be that somebody is facing, you know, quite a long prison sentence, and the police come along and say, "Hey, we've got a new."
I worked on informant recruitment for a long time. I had a very successful career recruiting informants nationally. So I would work for other police forces everywhere, really, overseas territories and everything, but also for the National Crime Agency, especially involving organised crime. So when you come to diligence, well, the fact of the matter is most informants, near enough all informants, come from the criminal community. So when you get these, and I can't stand them, these gangster podcasts when they go, "Yeah, we don't talk to the police." Absolute BS. It's total nonsense. All our sources came from the criminal community, all of them. And I listen to these podcasts, and they make me sick, some of them, because they go, "Well, I weren't a grass, they accused me of being a grass." And they go on about the testimony, and I know that they're a grass. I know they're an informant. And you see it by the very low sentences people get, the fact that they don't get arrested, and if they do, that it doesn't usually end up going through the judicial disposal system, or they get a light sentence, or if they do get a sentence, they get off on an appeal. That was always the main indicator, getting off on an appeal. But how it works is that someone's in trouble, and you approach them, whether you approach them in the cells when you deal with them, call it cell recruitment, or you approach them in prison. If you approach them in the cells, you might get told to F off because they've still got their trial, they're going to give it a go. But you tell them that you're going to lose 30% discount if you go to trial. You grass up now, you're going to get your 30%. Not only are you going to get it, I'm going to put in what's called a text, right? Not a phone text. It's a letter to the judge. And it goes through a special unit at Scotland Yard. And then first day of trial, I will supply the judge with that letter. And in it will be this defendant number two is a registered informant. He's got given good information, which has resulted in, it has to result in criminal convictions, and he is going to be of future use. And then you watch the ridiculously low sentences then people get. But the tail must never wag the dog. So we're in control. We make it clear to them. It's what we want, not what you want. We will take in consideration what you want. But if you need to be moved prison, we can do that. If you want your immigration state sorted out, we can do that. You know, we can do many things, new identities. It was commonplace, you know, and that's how it worked. The system works on information. If you were to run surveillance on someone, you'd need intrusive surveillance. Therefore, you'd need up to Home Secretary's authorization. Very difficult to do. You've then got to get into people's premises. There's a process of doing it, but it's complicated. It's intensive. It's high risk. And then you can bug their homes, and it's subject to a constant review. And surveillance, again, it's hit and miss. Surveillance, hit and miss. Mobile phones do a lot of the surveillance for people now, and a lot of criminals get caught because of mobile phones. But the best way is to have your man inside, have an informant. And when criminals are selfish people, right, they're selfish. They don't want to get up and earn an honest quid. They don't want to work 40 hours a week. They want to do what they want, when they want, with effort, right? They make out that they put together all this planning and all that. I've got no respect for criminals, as you can tell, right? But they don't. They want quick, hard money, and they want your money. And so when they get put away, their life comes to an end, and their selfishness kicks in even more. And they will grass people up. And that's what they do. They grass people up, and that's why people end up getting arrested later down the line, because they've been grassed up. And I work with young offenders now, and they all scratch their head and they say, "I don't know how I got caught." I said, "Well, I do. You were grass, mate. You were grass." So informants has always been, you know, the bread and butter of detective work. And it's not gone away. I don't hold up much hope for the police now. I think they're pretty much borderline useless. They tend to, without a doubt, pick low-hanging fruit more than they ever have done. They've lost tradecraft. They've lost a lot of the sterling old-school detectives, like myself and many others, and those that taught me. We're a thing of the past. We're dinosaurs. But it was all based on information. All of it was based on, and a detective was really gauged on how many sources, how many grasses, that he was running. And I used to run quite a few. I had, at one point, I had most of the homeless community of central London working for me. At one point, it sounds a bit exaggerated, but I had a lot of crackheads, homeless, heroin addicts, everything working for me, and they'd get paid. And for that week or so, they didn't have to go out shoplifting or whatever because we paid them out.
Lots of changes have taken place. We've just seen the Jewish Chronicle has just admitted that a lot of what they're saying is for the last couple of years has been fake news. It's all just Israeli intelligence service cut and paste into a newspaper. But when it comes down to it, there's one common factor with much of the decline that we've seen in the integrity of our institutions, John, you know, the police, the media, etc., including politicians. You know, who is it that appoints the ministers? Who is it that appoints the judges? Who is it that appoints the senior police officers? Who is it who's appointing army officers, for goodness sake? This is a guy called King Charles. Now, yeah. he's officially, if you ask, they'll say, oh, well, these are appointed on the recommendation of the Prime Minister, but we've had a succession now of very weak Prime Ministers who will do anything that they're told. Literally, if they're given a list, well, you know, they will just simply give that list. Then they have no principles. And when we've seen all this thing recently about just literally taking gifts from anybody at the Prime Minister, the Prime Minister's clothes, trips to go and see rock concerts and pop concerts and things like that being taken by the Prime Minister and his wife, Starmer, that is. So what do you make of Charles, his role? Because we've had this changeover, haven't we, between him and Elizabeth. Do you think there's really been any change in character at all?
Massively. So one thing the public need to understand is if we've got a right-wing government, the judiciary, the Attorney General's will be right-wing leaning. And when the left gets in, they get replaced with left-wing leaning. And that's how it's always been. So you would always have a political bias when a different side of politics gets in. And that's how it's always been. And ultimately, yeah, the Crown is there to hire and fire, but they will come under, you know, the representations of those lower down. So our whole judiciary would have changed the moment Starmer got in there. And of course, we saw that with what's happening with people going away for offences that a couple of years ago, even a couple of weeks ago, they would have got penalty charge notices for. Now, I said something to one of the whistleblowing cops, and I said, I don't think that the Crown has ever forgiven you for exposing what you did. And he exposed some people very high up in our political realm. And I said, if Charles, I refer to him as Sausage Fingers. I said, if Sausage Fingers gets in, I said, he's going to come for us lot. And straight away, we started seeing cases reopened on victims and survivors who made allegations. They went back and they started attacking the bravest police officer I've ever met, which is Mike Beale, who exposed Ted Heath, where people weren't going to believe what he was involved in, and now they do. He come under a renewed attack the moment Charles got in. That's not by accident. I think my opinion of Charles is a very, very damaged, nefarious individual indeed. And I think Queen Elizabeth, there a lot of people within the military and you know, her Crown servants on the civilian side, such as the police, did have a lot of respect for her. And I think they did. Not that it would ever happen, but if she was ever to offer me the Queen's Police Medal or an MBE or an OBE, I would have willingly accepted it. But I would not have the same opinion by accepting anything that was given to me by Charles. I wouldn't. I've heard things myself, which I won't repeat here about him. And again, as the old, as the adage goes, not my king. And I would stand by that. He's not my king. And I think we're going to see a lot of changes when it comes to the law, how big sexual offence cases such as Operation Conifer and Middleton and all the other ones involving organised and systemic child abuse. I don't think we will ever see anything of the like ever again under Charles. I don't think it will ever get to that. And I think he will deliberately underfund investigation units where child abuse is concerned. I genuinely believe he will fail the survivor community and the British public in general when it comes to child abuse investigations. I really do.
Maybe he really is. I mean, I think one of the big questions over Charles is this relationship with Mountbatten, who was himself bisexual and had an interest in young boys. Now, apparently, Mountbatten was Charles's mentor in his teenage years. Doesn't really seem like the best kind of person to be grooming Charles. There's also, you know, a few things which have come very much out in the public mind. One is Charles's very close relationship with Jimmy Savile, to the extent that he was actually asking Savile, and he asked him several times. This is in a documentary that came out in 2022. And all the evidence is most definitely there in Savile's own handwriting, and Charles's own handwriting on headed notepaper. He was begging Savile to write the public relations and press relations strategy for the royal family, and this is during Elizabeth's reign. But Charles was and Savile did this. There's also Peter Ball, who was the Bishop of Gloucester, who Charles was writing to the judges in the case of his paedophilia when he was a Bishop of Gloucester, asking him to be asking for him to get a reprieve from this prosecution. So Charles is defending a paedophile bishop, and he's also best mates with the most prolific paedophile in British history.
Well, let's break this down. I mean, let's start off with Mountbatten. The CIA just released their files on him, and they knew of his nefarious activities around young boys and the threat that he was to young boys. And they advised the British military that this man is not stable mind. He's got a paedophilic leaning, and he should not in any way be put in a place where he's a decision maker. And what did the British military do? They put him Admiral of the Fleet, where he had ultimate decision making, whereas it was warned not to. So they knew what he was doing. So you can't tell me our people didn't know what we're doing. But if we move then on to Bishop Ball, I mean, as a result of Bishop Ball, one young man killed himself. He was doing the most evil punishment to anyone under his pupillage. He was a typical paedophile. He was a deceiver. He would tell these young boys that came under his jurisdiction that they needed to suffer as of Lord Jesus Christ. And he would then say, we need to be in a place of redemption and humiliation. And what he was doing was whipping them, severely beating them, and then buggering them. And one young man killed himself. So in my opinion, he's a vicarious murderer. But not only did Charles protect him for 16 years at his royal residence, with all these allegations going on, Charles went on to denigrate the victims and call them liars once he was armed with all the information. This man should not be governing our country. He should not be in charge of our judicial system, our lawmakers, our policemen. He should not. This is a man who can't make the right decisions, and his influence is dirty. And same with Savile. I mean, come on. I mean, they all knew what he was doing. But all these files get locked away. They get locked away. And one day it will come out, and it'll be, but unfortunately, I think it'll be too late. But, you know, I don't really care what people's opinion of the police are. I think we went from having the safest capital city in the world. London was, and why was it? Because we had a police force that on the whole couldn't be corrupted. They were well paid, they were well maintained, they were well disciplined, and they were well present. They were every street corner had a copper on the beat. They got rid of that, and we have got one of the, well, it's an embarrassment, you know, to law and order, what we've got now. It's disgusting. There is no standards. It's just an absolute mess. And that, like the old adage, they couldn't nick themselves shaving unless a crime is backed up upon allegation with audio and visual footage. They do F all. 80% of all reported crimes in the metropolis are instantly written off because they're not instantly provable. Well, that's a police's job to investigate. That's a detective's job to go on a fishing expedition, find the evidence, whether it goes towards or away from a suspect, and then go to work. That's what we pay them for. But they don't do that anymore because they can't do that anymore and they're not allowed to do it anymore. It's a national disgrace, and they shut down police stations. Things evolve, Tony, right? Police stations evolve. They started off on the River Thames to police the boats from the East India Company with the Marine Police of London, which went on to become the most successful police force ever, right? And then it moved on to the Bow Street Runners. And these stations were placed, you know, in the epicenter of all our conurbations, whether they urban, rural, or semi-rural, they were there, right, where bus routes went, and everyone could pop in there and make an allegation 24 hours a day, no matter what the weather. They shut them all down. Police stations are on the periphery, the outskirts of our cities and urban areas now. A lot of them aren't even served by bus routes or transport connections. So how are the people meant to get there? And then you've got to go online. Well, what if you're old? What if there is no connectivity? What if you're ignorant to it? What if you're dyslexic? What if? You know, we had a perfect police force. It's a bit like our black cab drivers, the envy of the world, because there was a standard. There was a professionalism about them, a decency about them, something wholly British about them. And then they get Uber drivers and they're just a mess, you know.
What do you put all this? What do you put this decline down to?
Well, it's deliberate. It's deliberate. It's been a steady, steady race to the bottom. Whether they want to erode us as British people, turn us into morons, well, they've done a good job of that. I work, and I'm not denigrating anyone. My heart goes out to a lot of these young lads that get caught up in crime, because a lot of them are survivors of shy domestic circumstances, right? But so many of them are illiterate. They're inarticulate. You know, that if the white middle classes of this country knew the state of our young citizens of inner city areas, they'd be horrified. You know, they're borderline moronic, some of them. They can't articulate. They're ignorant. I cannot believe the ignorance of them. You know, one of them the other day didn't even know not where it was. He asked me what was Glasgow. And I couldn't believe it. And I told him it was a city in Scotland. And then he asked me, were there polar bears walking around the streets there? A grown man, you know, and he wasn't even retarded. But that's what he came out with. And it's that they've been failed. It's just a deliberate failing. They've cost cut. I don't know what they've done. But that they've deliberately done it, because no sane-minded, decent individual would allow this madness that we've got. And it is madness. We've got these young men in the morning are smoking skunk weed, cannabis of such high THC that they become paranoid. My friend, he's a long-term serving officer, probably one of the longest-serving murder squad detectives in the UK, a senior officer when he retired, spent all his career investigate murders. He said 80% of the murders in London are committed by young men with cannabis psychosis. It's crazy madness out there. And anyone who tells me cannabis is all right, well, it might have been in the 70s and the 80s when they had very weak resin that they sat round, and I don't know, it's not my thing. But what they're smoking now is mind-blowing madness. And combine that with a young, developing mind, brain, and combine that with someone who comes from trauma anyway, you know, you've got yourself ticking time bombs, and we're seeing that with the stabbings and the murders.
If someone gave you Mark Rowley's job, could you turn it around? Is it possible?
No, because Mark Rowley, whatever people think of him, he actually came to my assistance. He was an assistant commissioner then, and he overrode Cressida Dick, who I think she's vile. I openly called her a liar in a court case because she did lie. I've got no respect for her, but Mark Rowley actually assisted me. But bear in mind, Mark Rowley, when he walked out of a parliamentary meeting the other day, the other week, the other month, and he grabbed, there's a shock horror, Mark Rowley through a microphone of a journalist, right? Just after the riots had kicked off, Mark Rowley gets summons to this meeting. He turns up number 10, he goes in, he comes out, and he's a different man coming out as what he went on. And he gets accosted by a journalist who puts a microphone up his nose, and Rowley just picks it and chucks it. And he picked it and chucked it, not because he's unprofessional, you know, not because he's an idiot, because he's a man who has just experienced the total and utter denigration of the last bit of decency of our police. I guarantee you now, when he was in that meeting, Starmer told him his future and the future of policing, and it went against every sinew of professionalism and high expectations that man had for his force. I reckon he's been dictated to that this is what we're going to be doing now to the public. And I reckon it appalled, disgusted and horrified Mark Rowley. And that's why he picked that mic up and chucked it.
But it's interesting to hear you say that you think that he's maybe trying to do the right thing, but he's been completely blocked by his political masters. Anyway, look, you mentioned there this whole business of the so-called race riots led by Tommy Robinson in his kind of crew who started off as a sort of nationalist group, but then they very quickly turned into an Islamophobic group. And Robinson himself was actually let free the weekend before the riots by the Metropolitan Police and given his passport back. And of course, he immediately fled the country, even though he was due to appear in court. So it seems a bit strange for them to give him his passport. It's almost like saying, here's a quick get out of jail free card. And he went off to Cyprus and then to Israel. What do you make of this Tommy Robinson character?
It's a pseudonym anyway, isn't it, his name? I don't know him personally. He's got a huge following, and he has. In respect to that, I would have thought when I first started my campaigning, I got a lot of backing, a huge amount of backing, and I started getting approached by various organisations, from biker gangs to veterans to Black Cab Driving Association to the Fire Brigade Association, a lot of survivor groups of care homes. And we decided to have like a protest regarding no more cover-ups and everything else. And I was approached by the intelligence services and told, no, you're not doing it. Right. Now, I fought the police and I stood my ground with the police. But I'm not fighting the intelligence services. It's not happening. And what they said to me is that, you know, you get very, very popular. Right. Okay, you're an honourable man and everything else, but enough's enough, because I could potentially politically sway a percentage of the community, of the society, or whatever, and it was basically put in my ballpark, you know, don't really mess with us. So I would have thought that he will be very much on the radar of the intelligence services. Whatever his relationship with them is, I don't know. And a lot of the people that spoke at these rallies, from what happened afterwards, when they started arresting, it all seemed to coincide with each other, didn't it? And then when he left the country, there was this awful stabbing, the murders up in Southport, and then these riots kicked off. And then the police just went round dragging everyone in. And I put a warning out. I said, anyone who's had anything to do with this, you're going to get hit, and you're going to get hit incredibly hard. Now, I would have thought that they will be transcribing the speeches of anyone who's given a talk at these rallies to see if there is anything in any way in which is inflammatory or aiding and abetting, counselling or procuring race hate or Islamophobia or anti-Semitism or whatever it might be, and they'll come after them. So I don't know. It's not my flavour, Tony. It's not my flavour. I've turned up at a couple of these venues, and they've been peaceful enough. But there is an undercurrent, an undertone in it with some of the people who attend these things, which is one of violence. You know, you can see that. I know that, you know, the police have monitored him for a very, very long time. It's a difficult one because I was on a unit. We all got seconded in when the 2012 from 2010 to 2012 there was a huge wave of disorder and riots. It started off with the student riots, I think, of 2010, and then it went on to like the inner city riots and the Mark Duggan riots circa 2011-2012. So they dragged about 80 detectives in, and we just got, against our will, shoved into this covert unit of investigating public disorder. And we were given just unlimited resources. We were given 24-hour personal access to barristers and judicial decision makers, so we could get charges brought about at any time. 24-hour courts were brought in. And we had covert deployment, and we had infiltrators in a lot of these groups. I weren't part of that. I was part of the enforcement team. Wasn't really a highlight of my career, but I made a lot of money out of it, and that's how it was. But I know that the EDL were massively, massively scrutinised. And one day they turned up for some demonstration, and they decided to have it in Whitechapel. Now, of course, it was a ridiculous thing to do, but it was going to cause a lot of arguments and division and disruption, because that is the centre of the Muslim Bangladeshi community of the United Kingdom. And anyway, so the EDL, I think he was meant to turn up, then didn't, or whatever. But the rest of his foot soldiers were there and all that sort of stuff. And then the EDL realised it wasn't a good thing to carry on, so they decided to leave. And as they were leaving, the Bangladeshis attacked their coach or coaches and smashed them up. And a few of the EDL mob got out, British Bulldog stuff and all that, and wanted a fight, but just got beaten. Now, the order came out that no local Bangladeshi was to be arrested, right, on the day. But all the EDL got arrested. And it was quite unfair, to be honest, because it was my first example of two-tier policing. I then went with a senior officer to a meeting at Tower Hamlets Town Hall, where the mayor of Tower Hamlets, a Bengali guy, a Bangladeshi guy, was there. And he had his assistant, who was an ex-senior Metropolitan Police officer, with him. And then we had the superintendent of Tower Hamlets Police. And we were told, look, we got all this footage of local lads causing disorder, causing chaos, causing mayhem. And Tower Hamlets local police said, yeah, we've identified most of them, we know who they are. And the mayor of Tower Hamlets, via his lackey, turned around and said, it will be prudent for no locals, no Bangladeshis, to be arrested, because it might or might not have an effect on next year's funding. So basically, they were threatening the withdrawal of something like £1 million worth of local authority funding if any locals were arrested as a result of this disorder. So it goes on. Now, if it goes on that side, it will go on the other side. I just don't know. I've not got caught up in it, and nor will I get caught up in it, because it's not my thing. I think it's very divisive. So, you know, we'll wait and see. We'll wait and see. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of allegations that he's working for pro-Israeli groups and things like that. I don't know. Well, you know, it'll be someone else is probably better qualified to answer that one than me.
Yeah, interesting character. You know, the other thing, of course, is that we had the weirdness of the EDL popping up almost the same time as Al Majarun up in Luton back in, I think it was 2007. And we had also Nick Griffin and his allegations that the BNP was also approached by American funders saying, well, we would like to fund British nationalism, the BNP in this case, but you will have to stop criticising the banking system. And, of course, for example, the Islamic Republic of Iran do arrest bankers. They most definitely do. And some of them get capital sentences in Iran. For, you know, it's basically cheating the banking system. That doesn't really happen in Britain or the United States anymore. So, yeah, this one does wonder about whether or not British nationalism generally has been hijacked into becoming this kind of Islamophobic.
The other thing is, and I'm going to tell you now, as someone who used to do it, if someone gets arrested involving this being an instigator of it or a mouthpiece for it, and they go to prison, I pretty much guarantee they'll get a visit from Special Branch, from a source recruitment team like I was, and maybe they'll offer them a deal. But I'm telling you what, we used to do it all the time. Now, I never did it in respect to political disorder and things like that, but I definitely did it when it came to organized criminality, drugs, fraud, violence, importation, everything, child abuse, a lot. Definitely did it. So without a doubt it will be done on civil disorder and public disorder, without a doubt. And also that group or whatever it is, that following, will be heavily, heavily infiltrated. No two ways about it. They will be heavily infiltrated, without a doubt. I guarantee it. And they won't know who is and who isn't, you know. And they'll say, oh, this bloke's been my foot soldier for you know, 20 years, I vouch for him. Well, look at the case of Donny Brasco, you know. You know, went alongside, you know, the mafia for years and years and years, and they still didn't know. Look at the who's the Scaccinelli? Is it Scaccinelli, the IRA, you know, sort of torture organizer? He was in charge of. That guy with the Italian surname. Again, him. He's just come out what he was doing. He was playing both sides. And, you know, and he would punish someone, even with execution, if they were talking to the peelers, to the police.
Here's a question, Joe. Yeah, I know, it was horrific. And he was basically the British Army's infiltrator who was deciding who lived and who died within the IRA. Right. Amazing, really.
And it will be the same with this alt-right movement. I'm telling you now, it will be exactly the same. I'm not accusing anyone of being an informant because I'm not qualified to say that. But I am qualified to say that without a doubt, the police will be having a go at trying to get people working for them.
Here's the nub of the point, though, John. If you're running some sort of legitimate protest group, how do you? What advice would you have to those running it to find out if someone is actually a police informant in your group?
Well, firstly, you'll never know. But one of the ways. In which there was one particular very successful criminal in the north of England, and he knew that the police, the intelligence services, don't have to do this, right? But the police have to go through a thing called the ECHR, the European Court of Human Rights, 2000, and it really is the sort of do's and don'ts of any intelligence agency, civilian intelligence agency. Military one, no, they'll do their thing. So I can't say if what MI5, MI6 do or don't do, but the police aren't allowed to use children, and you know they're not. The risk is too high. So what this guy would do, that if someone turned up new and tried to get involved and all that, he'd say, well, look, we're having a barbecue around the house. Bring your kids. And if they can bring little children, not teenage kids, little children along, he would sack them off. And someone said to him once, well, you know, you could be losing a lot of business. He said, I don't care. I know the police can't use little children as participating informants. So on a high risk job. So if they can't, you know, a lot of them say they divorce, they move to the area and all this, you know, got a missus who's also old Bill. And how it works is you will have to be introduced by someone, but that person will introduce, this person will introduce you. You're like two steps away from the actual source. So it's very clever, very well worked out way of doing it. And again, participating in the commission of a crime, well, it's allowed. You can have participating informants. It happens. I suppose one of the ways is inject heroin with them or something like that. I don't know, smoke crack with them, but you know, I don't know. But it gets to a point where it's too high risk and they have to withdraw. But this northern gangster, he knew exactly how far it could or couldn't go. But again, the police would profile the guy, so they knew he had a weakness, and his weakness was gambling. So they got him through there. They got someone in via the gambling side of it.
You mentioned the massive rise in knife crime in London particularly, but also right across the country. There are groups out there that actually do encourage and groom online young kids to kill. One of them is called the Order of the Nine Angles. It's known as a Satanist group, a Nazi group, a fascist group, a far-right group. And over the years, there's been various lobbying of the Home Office, now Yvette Cooper. In fact, she herself called on previous Home Secretaries to proscribe this organisation. And one of the most pernicious things about it is you apparently get promoted through it the more murders you do. So what is this organisation to your knowledge, and how come it's still allowed to function?
Well, as you know, one of the few people who talks out about satanic ritual abuse and its reality in the murder of children, the torture of children, and ritual abuse is also one of the biggest providers of snuff and child pornography, and it's a huge money-making revenue. Many Western countries realise that ritual abuse goes on and have special occultic crime units. The NYPD has one, Johannesburg's got one, and London being the most diverse capital city in the world, you know, an ex-colonial, so we've got people that come from source witchcraft countries, you know, the Caribbean, they have Obia, Juju, Kindoko, Mooty killings. I mean, I can go through a whole raft of it. You've also got a form of witchcraft from Romania, from Indonesia, and everything else. And the Nine Angles is a satanic order, and it is occultic, and it's bizarre because it's paramilitary at the same time, and there have been quite a few high-profile followers. One of them was a guy called David Copeland, who was the nail bomber who went on to blow up a gay bar in Old Compton Street, the Emerald Duncan, and then he blew up, put a nail bomb in Brick Lane, which failed to go off, but he also put one in Electric Avenue in Brixton just to cause chaos, and he was a staunch follower. He wasn't, I think, a ratified member. But when, in order to go in there, it's hugely hierarchical. And like I say, they warrant them according to their murders. But part of the initiation is that they have to undertake mental and physical tasks, which are almost akin to an elite military regiment. You know, one is to walk 30 miles with something like 35 kilos on your back in an incredibly short period of time. Cycle 200 miles in 12 hours. I mean, it's just superhuman. But people do it. I think there's a guy called David Moyles is one of the main pushers of this thing. But it's alive and it's well, and it does target the alt right. It targets the right leaning members. I think there was like Combat 18 and them sort of skinhead Oi music movements. One of them was sort of had affiliations to the Order of Nine Angles. It's dangerous, and it is Satan worship. And they use a sort of a Crowley-esque type doctrine. And, yeah, a very, very bizarre thing. I've done, you know, I have done research into it. And I'm aware of you know, the member, the founder member in the UK, he was a monk for a while. And then he became, you know, a staunch Catholic. And then he converted to Islam while still being a member of the Order of Nine Angles. Strange individual, but it is alive, it is well, and it does crop up with alarming regularity in some of the testimonies I receive from victims and survivors of ritual abuse.
Yeah, so why is it, well, not banned? Obviously, it should be, you know, you've got Hamas, which is the elected government of Gaza, is proscribed, but the Order of Nine Angles isn't.
Yeah, I know. It's alarming. It should be, and it just goes to show the lackluster approach and I suppose the deliberate ignorance, the cognitive dissonance of our cabinet ministers not to accept that this sort of occultic fanaticism goes on, and it's frightening, and it does go on. It really does go on, and like most things, it's occultic, it's covert, it's hidden. It's not going to smack you in the face, but it is there. And it has
I mean, the reason it doesn't smack you in the face, what amazes me is all the billions of pounds poured into the London press. There's hardly a mention of it ever. Anyway, look, John, if people are interested in following you, following your work, whereabouts do you most regularly pop up? Where can they find you?
I do a regular show with Sean Atwood on... Sean Atwood show on a Tuesday, do a crime theory on a Thursday night. I used to do quite regular little podcasts myself, but sounds a bit horrible, but I started dealing with a lot of people with profound mental health problems, and they ended up treating me like their unpaid counsellor, and when I didn't do what they wanted, they turned on me and all sorts. So I sort of withdrew from public life a little bit, but
is when you help people who are mentally ill, you will find yourself quite often at the brunt yes. of their anger, yeah. you know, which is yeah. mental ill.
It is, yeah, yeah, and that's the sad thing. It was projection. They would blame me, and then I'd be accused of working for the government, and and all sorts of things. You know that John Wedger works for MI5, and you know. So if only I did, I'd be gaining two pensions by now. But I do crop up. I'm on Facebook. I'm on TikTok, I pop up every now and then. Someone said be like a submarine, you know. Every now and then, come up for a little while, then go back under. So I'm sort of hedgehogging at the moment. I'm keeping my head down, but I will be making a burst of public appearances in the very near future. And I'm in the process of writing a book, so I'll be bringing out an autobiography soon, all about police cover-ups, police corruption, and the extent that the police and the government will go to shut things up. In trying to do it in a non-conspiratorial way, because there are good police officers out there, there are good politicians out there. It's not all lost, but it's just very precarious, sort of heartbreaking times at the moment.
Okay, John Wedger, thanks very much for joining us.
God bless you. Thanks ever so much, Tony.